Welcome to the reading of the Quad City Times for today, Friday, January 12th. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of people with print disabilities. Your readers today are Scott Splavik, and my name is Rachel Mithelman. And here is Scott with our first story.
Thank you, Rachel. And the top story on the Quad City Times today is Blizzard Bearing Down. Gretchen Teske, Sarah Watson, and Grace Kinnicott contributed to this article. Nearly 24 hours of snow and incredibly strong winds had the National Weather Service issuing a blizzard warning for the Quad Cities region. The NWS defines a blizzard warning as sustained winds or frequent gusts of at least 35 miles per hour at the same time as considerable falling and or blowing snow for at least 3 hours. Visibility will be reduced to less than a quarter mile during a blizzard, according to the NWS. Unlike the storm on Tuesday, the weekend's storm is expected to bring widespread winds that will blow the falling snow. The storm is expected to start early Friday morning, close to midnight, and continue into Saturday, ending around 3 a.m. As Saturday drags on, the storm is expected to weaken. Friday, wind is expected to pick up close to noon, clocking in at about 28 miles per hour. It will get stronger as the night continues, peaking at about 43 miles per hour by 6 p.m. Those strong winds will continue overnight, gradually dying down to about 30 miles per hour by noon Saturday. Wind speed will continue to drop the rest of the weekend, settling in the mid-20s. Wind chills will be a major point of concern Sunday through Wednesday, with a range of negative 21 to negative 37 expected. Snow is coming along with this storm, bringing 8 to 12 inches for those north of Interstate 80 and 6 to 8 inches for the rest of the Quad Cities area. Wind will also be a factor as the snow will have a high water content but light and fluffy in consistency. The National Weather Service predicts snow will begin in the Quad Cities between 11 p.m. Thursday night and 1 a.m. Friday morning. It will continue to fall all day on Friday, wrapping up in the early hours Saturday morning. Coupled with the expected winds, blowing and drifting snow is expected to impact travel. Overnight Friday, 2 to 6 inches of snow is likely, with the snow continuing through the day. South of Interstate 80, the snow is expected to decrease and switch temporarily to a mix of rain or freezing rain. This is only expected to last an hour or two. Temperatures from Friday through Sunday will remain below freezing on Friday and drop significantly as the weekend continues. Saturday's high is expected to be 17 and Sunday's close to zero. Several cities declared snow emergencies ahead of the coming snowstorm. Davenport's starts at 6 p.m. Thursday and expected to end at 6 p.m. Sunday. Moline, Rock Island, and Silvis also declared a snow emergency. Moline's begins 6 a.m. Thursday and lasts until Sunday, January the 14th at 6 a.m. The snow emergency for Silvis began 5 p.m. Wednesday and lasts until noon on Saturday. Parking is prohibited on posted snow routes when snow emergencies are in effect. Davenport will start enforcement of parking restrictions once snow begins to fly, according to the city. The three city parking ramps downtown offer free parking during snow emergencies. In Rock Island, parking is not allowed once the snow depth reaches 2 inches. In Moline, residents must move parked vehicles off designated snow routes. Cities urged residents to park off-street for snowplows to efficiently move through city streets.
1.6 million dollar gift to food bank. This is by Gretchen Teske of the Quad City Times. Meals for residents in Dubuque, Scott, and Rock Island counties have been secured for 1 year, thanks to generous donations from the community. The Riverbend Food Bank in Davenport supports multiple counties in the region, but was awarded a check of $1.6 million on Thursday afternoon. Thanks to community support, support and a matching pledge from John Deere. In May of 2021, the John Deere Foundation, which is the philanthropic arm of Deere and Company, announced it would invest $200 million over the next 10 years. The foundation has routinely exceeded its goal of donating $20 million a year and is on track to donate nearly $35 million by the end of 2024, pushing the foundation halfway to its goal in just 4 years. The foundation's overall goal is to support the community, said John Deere Global Corporate Social Responsibility Lead Laura Eberlin. Ending hunger and food insecurity plays right into that, she said. For the last several decades, the foundation has been a supporter of the food bank and ramped up its efforts last year by sitting down with leaders to establish what it could do to help. Eberlin said with food donations down and food costs up, a solution was needed. Enter the Community Match Campaign. With a plan devised, the foundation went back to River Bend, where Executive Director Nancy Renkus did an inventory of how much it would cost to end hunger in Rock Island, Scott, and Dubuque counties for 1 year. With a figure of $1.3 million, Deere divided that number in half and promised to match donations up to $650,000, Eberlin said. We are going to match the community one for one to share in this mission together because we know no one single person or entity can end hunger alone, she said. We were able to show the power of community and what the power of community can do. Thursday, during a check presentation, Eberlin announced that fundraising goal was exceeded with a whopping $1,611,200 donated to the food bank. Renkus said during the presentation the extra funding will help to continue purchasing food and give staff a chance to reevaluate how best to continue helping the community. This money will allow us to step back and really determine what can be done on our end, she said. Food prices and demand are both up, and donations are down due to inflation. With 23 counties relying on River Bend, Renkus said time is of the essence, and planning for the future needs to begin now. For the Deere Foundation, that's already started. Eberlin said in addition to the financial goal, the foundation has committed to delivering 100 million meals to those in need. By the end of 2024, they are on track to have donated more than 40 million. She said, as we look ahead, we're going to continue to do what we do in supporting our communities to tackle the world's biggest problems. Moline's mayor, Sangeetha Rayapati, said having a company like John Deere in Moline helps promote the city's goal of community first. The mayor said, if leaders are not willing to take tangible action to provide hope and an active vision, then all we can expect is more of the same and lack of progress. In Moline, we have hope and we have a vision.
In another weather-related article, forecast freezes ice extravaganza. Ice sculpture event canceled because of extreme weather. This is written by Gannon Hannevold of the Quad City Times. It'll be too chilly for even ice this weekend in the Quad Cities. The Downtown Davenport Partnership announced Thursday afternoon that Ice Extravaganza, the three-day ice sculpture demonstration at Freight House Farmers Market, will be canceled. The event, which has been a local staple since the year 2013, was originally scheduled to run Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. We love ice extravaganza so much, but expected conditions are simply unsafe to host the event this year, said Kyle Carter, executive director at the Downtown Davenport Partnership. The Quad Cities Chamber Coffee Meetup, originally slated for Friday at 7:30 a.m., has also been canceled in anticipation of extreme weather. The National Weather Service of the Quad Cities shared Thursday morning that the wind chill will fall below zero on Saturday, remaining there through most of next week. A very complex system with cold air and strong winds are likely Friday evening through Saturday, the NWS Quad Cities said in a social media post on Thursday. Blowing and drifting snow will be possible with this system. Travel will be difficult. They added that there would be a 50% chance of blizzard conditions in eastern Iowa Friday night into Saturday morning, with 4 to 10 inches of snow expected. Downtown Davenport Partnership Program Director Alicia Espy said earlier this week that based on prior years, the organization was expecting thousands to extend the ice extravaganza. Espy added that the Downtown Davenport Partnership had ordered 18 tons of ice blocks for 6 different mostly local sculptors to work with. Earlier this week, Downtown Davenport shared videos of the sculptures in progress to Instagram and Facebook. The good news, some of the sculptures have already been finished, according to the announcement shared on Thursday. Carter urged Quad Cityans to still come see the artists' work when weather permits. We encourage folks to come downtown and support small businesses at the Freight House later this week, he said.
5 things to know heading into the Iowa caucuses. This is by Caleb McCullough of the Quad City Times. Iowa's first in the nation caucuses are in just 5 days. The caucus locations have been set, the victory parties are planned, and there's not much time left to change the outcome. Candidates are participating in last-minute media events and will hold events before the weekend as they seek to rally any final undecided voters for their support. Here are 5 things to consider before going into the big day. Number 1, Donald Trump will probably win. One big story that will come out of this caucus campaign is how little ever changed at the top of the pack. In May of 2023, according to 538's average of Iowa caucus polls, Donald Trump had 48% of support from likely caucus goers. Today, that number stands at 51.3%. His lead only seems to be widening, and his supporters are fervent and energetic, but there is likely some segment of his supporters that are not plugged in enough to politics to know all the details of how and where to caucus. While Trump has not visited the state as much as many of his other opponents, his campaign has worked to convert those less politically active voters with commit-to-caucus events and widespread organizing, encouraging voters to turn out to the caucus and bring their friends. Barring something truly unexpected, Donald Trump will almost certainly win the Iowa caucuses on Monday. The open question is who will take second place. Number 2, DeSantis needs to get a strong second. DeSantis has pinned his hopes to beat Donald Trump on doing well in Iowa. Nikki Haley is positioned to beat him by a big margin in New Hampshire, and DeSantis supporters see a big upset in Iowa as the only way to stave off a campaign nosedive through the early states. To remain relevant going into New Hampshire, DeSantis will likely need to outperform the polls handily, receiving well into the 20 or 30% level of support, and show that his campaign has organizing might and his message is resonating with people. That will be made even more difficult by the fact that Chris Christie dropped out of the race on Wednesday. His supporters, some of the strongest never-Trump voters in the party, may go to Haley after his exit, beefing up her support at a key time before the caucuses. Number 3, this could be a big moment for Nikki Haley. Nikki Haley has been seeing momentum in Iowa in the last few weeks. She's racking up important endorsements all over the TV airwaves and has the door-knocking might of Americans for Prosperity. In recent polling, she's usually within 3 points of DeSantis, if not tied or ahead. Christie's exit could give her the boost she needs to nab a second-place finish. If she can manage to take second place in the state, that will be a huge victory for her going into New Hampshire, where some polls show her within just a few points of beating Donald Trump. The results here will determine just how much energy is behind Haley Inn and the legitimacy of her claim to be the sole challenger to Trump. Number four, who will drop out? The candidates running for president may use the results in Iowa as a litmus test for whether they should stay in the race or exit after failing to gain traction. Asa Hutchinson has been polling at around 1% in the state for months, but he's committed to sticking through to the caucuses. Will Iowa be the end of Asa 2024, or will he stick it out to New Hampshire? The same can be said for Ramaswamy. His polling numbers are well below that of DeSantis and Haley. He has made big predictions that a silent majority of non-traditional caucus goers will lead to a shock on caucus night and drive him to finish near the top. If that doesn't happen, he doesn't have much to lean on going into New Hampshire. And number five, watching the temperatures. Monday has a low temperature of minus 10 degrees. With wind chill, that could drop even lower. Iowans are generally used to the cold, but once the temperature gets into the double digits below zero, that may have an impact on turning people away from driving into town at night and spending an hour caucusing. I don't think the impact will be major, but it may very well be noticeable. It is not expected to snow on Monday, but if it does, that may deter even more people. When the weather is a barrier, turnout is even more important, and we may see a big advantage to the candidate with the most dedicated and committed supporters. Each candidate naturally is trying to claim their supporters as the ones who will brave any weather to cast their vote. We'll have to see how that plays out on Monday. And finally, the author writes, "What I'm reading." Chris Christie drops out of 2024 presidential race by Nick Corasaniti of the New York Times. Chris Christie's exit from the Republican presidential campaign was overshadowed by a hot mic incident in which he criticized Nikki Haley and other Republican candidates. Forecast predicts frigid Iowa caucus night. Will it impact voter turnout? This by Tom Barton of the Gazette. Iowa's caucus night weather could be the coldest ever. Will Republican voters still brave the weather to cast their votes for president?
On page A3, $900,000 grant to fund clubhouse. State grant to fund 90% of building at Saki Golf Course. This is written by Grace Kinnicott of the Quad City Times. Saki Golf Course will receive a new clubhouse with state funding to help cover the cost. The city was awarded $901,800 from the Park and Recreation Facility Construction Act grant program. Plans are currently underway to replace the 95-year-old clubhouse. Assistant Parks and Recreation Director Todd Winter said the grant will help cover a majority of the costs. The grant will cover about 90% of the costs, Winters said. But there's still fundraising to be done to cover the last $100,000. The goal is to begin construction this year, Winters said, and to have the new clubhouse completed by the spring of 2025. The current 95-year-old clubhouse has exceeded its useful life and is in a state of deterioration, the city's announcement states. The new clubhouse will include a meeting space, seating areas, offices, a kitchen, dining area, two golf simulators, and outdoor seating facing the course. The existing clubhouse will remain until the new one is completed. Financing of the new facility will include the grant, a grant match from the city's general fund, and private donations, according to city budget documents. The goal is to create a more welcoming and fully accessible space and to provide year-round space for various activities with indoor hitting, bays, and simulators. State Representative Greg Johnson, a Democrat from East Moline, said the much-needed improvements at Saki Golf Course are going to make a difference for the local economy and bring in more tourism dollars. Building a stronger future for our community starts with steady economic growth, Johnson said. State Senator Mike Halpin, a Democrat from Rock Island, said the grant from the state was a significant investment for revitalization efforts in Rock Island. You can learn a lot about a community by the way they invest in publicly accessible recreation for residents, Halpin said. The Illinois Department of Natural Resources administers the program and is part of Governor J.B. Pritzker's Rebuild Illinois Capital Improvement Program. Another short article from page A3, man gets jail for traffic stop that left officer injured. This is written by Anthony Watts of the Quad City Times. A Davenport man accused of resisting arrest and interfering with an investigation during a traffic stop received 120 days in jail after accepting a plea agreement. Bettendorf police officers conducted the stop on a 2005 Pontiac Grand Prix GT around midnight on October the 8th on the ramp from Middle Road to westbound Interstate 74, according to Scott County records. Authorities allege that Coriante C. Williams, age 25, was a passenger in that car. Allegations against him include that there was an open bottle of alcohol at his feet, that there was a pellet gun under his seat, that he had less than an ounce of marijuana in a baggie on his person, and that he gave a false name to officers. After officers found the marijuana, Williams struggled with them and resisted arrest, court records state. During that altercation, one officer suffered a hand injury and police used pepper spray. An officer was exposed to the pepper spray, causing pain. It was unclear if it was the same officer whose hand was injured. Initially, Williams faced numerous charges and one citation in relation to the October 8th arrest. Those counts were interference with official acts, bodily injury, possession of a controlled substance, third or subsequent offense, person ineligible to carry dangerous weapons, provide false information, fifth-degree criminal mischief, and a citation for open container. In late December, District Associate Judge Christine Dalton sentenced William to 120 days in the Scott County Jail, each on the count of interference with official acts, bodily injury, and possession of a controlled substance, second offense, marijuana, according to court records. Both charges are misdemeanors. In a separate case, the judge also sentenced him to 120 days in the jail on account of fourth-degree criminal mischief, court records state. The sentences in the two cases are concurrent to each other, and Williams will also receive credit for time served. Williams entered into the plea agreement with the Scott County Attorney's Office on December 28th. The agreement reduced the possession charge and dropped the personal ineligible charge, according to court records. The agreement also involved dismissing the criminal mischief and providing false identification charges and the open container citation.
A little more caucus news. King and Owens rallying voters. This by Sarah Watson of the Quad City Times. With the Republican Iowa caucuses just days away, entrepreneur Vivek Ramaswamy is fielding campaign help from his endorsers. Controversial former U.S. Representative Steve King and Republican political commentator Candace Owens campaigned with Ramaswamy on Thursday morning in Davenport, with just 4 days to go until the January 15th Republican caucuses. King endorsed Ramaswamy, he said, because of Ramaswamy's hard positions against illegal immigration and carbon capture pipelines. King said, "Vivek hits all the points that I believe in, all the way down the line. He's got a plan to strip government down and a plan to get us back where we get our freedom back. We're pressed by taxes and debt and regulations and the intrusion into our lives." Ramaswamy pledged, as he has before, to cut 75% of the federal workforce, fight against carbon capture pipelines and the climate change agenda, end U.S. involvement in foreign wars, and dissolve the U.S. Department of Education and the FBI. He also pledged to deport any person who entered the country illegally. Ramaswamy pitches himself as a younger version of former President Donald Trump, who can take over the movement if legal woes or other forces keep Trump from the White House. He's also mostly self-funding his campaign, which he argues means he doesn't answer to big campaign donors. If you want to save Trump, you want to save this country, and what our movement represents, a vote for me is the way to do it, Ramaswamy said. Ramaswamy, who has been polling in the single digits behind frontrunners Trump, Governor Ron DeSantis, and former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley, asked the audience to brave the cold to caucus for him on Monday. Monday's temperatures aren't expected to reach above freezing, and the caucus time temperature is expected to be 5 degrees below zero. Republicans and Democrats in Iowa will each caucus at 7 p.m. Monday. Republicans will pick who they support for president. Democrats, who are doing a mail-in caucus system for the first time this year, won't select their preference for president at Monday's caucuses, but will discuss party platform. Leilani and Derek Lingle brought their 5-month-old daughter, Elena, to the 8 a.m. event to see Owen speak. They've heard Ramaswamy speak before and plan to be firmly in his camp on caucus night. Leilani said it's the first time she's thrown her support behind someone she didn't think would win, but she said Ramaswamy aligned the most with her values. She said, I want to be able to tell my child who I voted for. She said she's not confident Trump knows what he's doing, calling his previous administration a lot of hirings and firings. If Ramaswamy doesn't win the nomination and it's a rematch between Trump and President Joe Biden, Derek said he plans to vote for a third-party candidate. I don't think Trump got a lot accomplished, Derek said.
Also, Carson Others stump for Trump, ex-HUD secretary among surrogates in Iowa for caucuses. It's written by Sarah Watson. As a West Davenport church at a West Davenport church Wednesday night, former opponent Ben Carson tried to assuage any potential misgivings about Donald Trump. The thing about Donald Trump, I will admit that sometimes he says some pretty weird things, Carson said, but you have to watch what he does. Carson said Trump signed more executive orders for religious liberty than any other president, and his administration advocated for more U.S. fuel production and reduced regulations. Would you rather have somebody whose tongue is maybe a little wild but has incredibly good policies that make your life better? Carson asked. Or somebody who has a silver tongue and says all the right things and has terrible policies which ruin your life and those of your children and grandchildren? Other Republicans in the race for the nomination have pointed out that Trump can only serve one more term and say that limits what he'll be able to do in office. Carson, however, spun it as a benefit. Another incredible thing about Donald Trump, when he's elected, he can't be reelected, so he's not going to be doing stuff to get reelected. He's going to be doing stuff that makes America great again, Carson said to applause from the audience. Carson also elicited claps when he talked about the family structure. I think it's also vitally important that we bring the family, Carson said to outbursts of yeah and applause. Carson, referencing his own story growing up in poverty, said it was because of values in his mother that his mother instilled in him that they rose up out of poverty. Nearly every seat was taken in the sanctuary. At least 100 people turned up to see Carson. Carson is one of several surrogates campaigning for Trump in Iowa ahead of Monday's caucuses. Donald Trump Jr. is campaigning in Iowa for his father this week, and others, such as South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem and Georgia Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, stumped for Trump earlier this month. Carson told reporters he was campaigning for Trump because of Trump's legal schedule didn't allow him to travel to Iowa much. Denise Jones, age 64, Davenport, said she attends Grace Family Church and came to support. She plans to caucus on Monday, braving the forecasted frigid temperatures for Trump. While he was president, she said she felt better about the economy and there weren't as many foreign conflicts. Plus, her favorite brand of cereal costs about $2 to $3 less. "Let's get back to that," Jones said. She said she likes Ron DeSantis and Vivek Ramaswamy, but decided she would stick with the former president after she saw attacks on the former president. She caucused for Marco Rubio in 2016, and her husband caucused for Cruz. She said they were very cautious about Trump, but ended up voting for him. "We're pleased with what he did," Jones said.
It's time to turn to the obituaries that are in today's Quad City Times. I'll start with the pending services. First, Lynn Justine Mekshis, age 70, formerly of Bettendorf, died on Tuesday, January 9th. J.W. Johnson, age 80, of Milan, Illinois, died Wednesday, January 10th. Robert Hine, age 82, of Letts, Iowa, passed away Wednesday, January 10th. Richard A. Lundy, age 75, of Rock Island, Illinois, died Thursday, January 11th. Jackie S. Anderson, age 68, of Milan, Illinois, died Wednesday, January 10th. Earl H. Cool, age 88, of Eldridge, Iowa, passed away Tuesday, January 9th. Teddy Lowell Eddington, age 89, of Moline, passed away Tuesday, January 9th. Cora Ann Schaffman, age 90, of Milan, Illinois, died on Thursday, January 11th. John T. Hohenschel, age 88, of Davenport, died on Wednesday, January 10th. And Hel D. Moore, age 89, of Rock Island, died on Thursday. Those people all have services pending. I'll read the next two obits, Scott, if you'll take the three after that. The first obituary is for Bella Hunky Hummel. Bella, or Hunky Hummel, age 88, of Eldon, Iowa, formerly of Davenport, passed away January 9th at Hospice House in Ottumwa, surrounded by his family at the time of his passing. Funeral services will be held at 1 p.m. Wednesday, January 17th, at Helligan McCabe DeVries Funeral Home, with visitation being held from 11 until the time of service at the funeral home. Additional visitation will be held from 11 to 2 on Monday, January 15th, at Cranston Funeral Home in Fairfield, Iowa. Burial will be at Mount Calvary Cemetery, Davenport. Memorials may be made to the Scott County Humane Society. Bella was born October 1, 1935, in the nation of Hungary, to Jano and Anna Hummel. He was united in marriage to Wilma Rainey on October 17, 1959. Bella came to the United States in 1957 and became a U.S. citizen in 1962. Bella worked at Continental Cement Plant, formerly Dewey Portland, in Buffalo, Iowa, for 33 years. He retired in May of 1990 and moved to Eldon, Iowa, in June of 1990. Bella enjoyed hunting, bowling, his family, and making friends. He made friends everywhere he went. Those left behind are his loving wife, Wilma, daughters Ida and Eva, grandchildren Christy, Lisa, and Julia, and great-grandchildren Amber, Lillian, Jordan, Olivia, Alicia, Miguel, Lavar, and Gianna, and his sister, Giuliano, of Hungary. He was preceded in death by his grandparents, his parents, a brother, Giza Hummel, all of Hungary. The next obituary is for Carolyn M. Hitchcock. Carolyn M. Hitchcock, age 82, of Sherrard, passed away Monday, January 8th, at home surrounded by her loving family. A memorial service will be held at 10 a.m. Monday, January 15th, at Whelan Presley Funeral Home and Crematory in Rock Island. Visitation will be Sunday from 2 to 5 p.m. at the funeral home. Private interment will be in Swadona Lutheran Cemetery. Memorials may be left to St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital, National Breast Cancer Foundation, or Swadona Lutheran Church. Survivors include her husband, Dennis, son, Brett Hitchcock, with spouse, Christina, daughter and son-in-law, Darcy and John McCaw, and grandchildren, Kaylee, Mason, and great-grandson, Alex.
Continuing with the obituaries, next we remember Delmar Ray Snowball Meyer, age 89, of Bluegrass, Iowa, who passed away Monday, January the 8th, 2024, at Leland Smith Assisted Living in Wilton. Visitation will be held from 2 to 5 p.m. Sunday, January the 14th, 2024, at Bentley Funeral Home, Durant. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. Monday at the funeral home. Burial will be in Walcott Cemetery, with military rites accorded by the Walcott American Legion. Memorial contributions may be made to the Bluegrass Firefighters or Walcott American Legion. Online condolences may be left for the family at www.bentleyfuneralhome.com. Delmar was born in Scott County, Iowa, on August the 14th of 1934 to Julius and Bertha Leish Meyer. He proudly served his country in the United States Marines. He married Patricia Rorick on January the 25th, 1954, in Grand Mound. She preceded him in death on April 15th, 1983. He later married Carol Leggins on February 18th, 1990, in Las Vegas. Snowball farmed in Scott County for 45 years, retiring in 2001. He was a member of the Bluegrass and Walcott Community Clubs, the Walcott American Legion Post number 548, and Farm Bureau. He enjoyed going to the casino and playing cards with family and friends. Most of all, he loved spending time with his family and attending his grandchildren's activities. Snowball is survived by his wife, Carol, three children, Steve, spouse Phyllis Meyer of Davenport, Bruce, spouse Paula Meyer of the Villages of Florida, and Lisa, spouse Tim Wessel of Davenport, stepsons Jeff Leggins of Loudoun, Brian Leggins of Wilton, and Dean Leggins of Bennett, nine grandchildren, 10 great-grandchildren, and his brother Laverne, spouse Shirley Meyer. He was preceded in death by his wife Patricia, five brothers, Arnie, Bill, Tuffy, Herb, and Milton Meyer, and three sisters, Ethel Moeller, June Severs, and Betty Meyerhofer, and granddaughter Shelby Axline. Next, we remember Pat Fisher, age 74, of Bettendorf, who passed away Wednesday, January the 10th, 2024. Per her wishes, she will be cremated, with a visitation to be held on Wednesday, January the 24th, from 10 to 12 p.m. at the Rungi Mortuary. Full obituary and online condolences may be expressed at www.rungimortuary.com. Pat was born April 14, 1949, to Nick and Mary Ellis Bird in Davenport. On May 1, 1975, she was united in marriage to Galen Fisher of Moline, Illinois. She was employed for Romberg Furriers International Harvester in East Moline, then Rock Island Arsenal, where she later retired. And finally, we remember Ruth H. Otteson. A gathering of family and friends of Ruth H. Otteson, O-T-T-E-S-E-N, will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. on Monday, January the 15th, in the conservatory at Vander Veer Botanical Park, 215 West Central Park Avenue in Davenport. Contributions in her memory may be made to the Friends of Vander Veer Botanical Park. Mrs. Otteson, age 81, a resident of Davenport, died on Saturday, December the 2nd, 2023, at the Clarissa Cook Hospice House in Bettendorf. Among survivors is her husband, James. To view her complete obituary, please visit www.mcginnis-chambers.com.
To turning to the opinion page of the Quad City Times. First, the cartoon by Mike Lukovich is set in an airplane with the flight attendant giving the usual safety rundown, but this time she's saying, "This is a Boeing jet. Should bolts loosen? Wrenches will fall from the overhead compartment." Extremists undercut prospects for peaceful coexistence. This opinion piece is by Mark Schwelbert. He's a lawyer and a former mayor of Rock Island. On October 7th last year, Israel experienced an event similar to what our nation faced on September 11th, 2001. A premeditated terrorist attack calculated to inflict maximum injury to innocent civilians was carried out by the terrorist group Hamas. Like Al-Qaeda on 9/11, Hamas represents a radical group of violent religious extremists, bent on advancing their twisted view of Islam by committing acts that shock the conscience and rightfully rouse outrage. As in the days after 9/11, Israel, like the United States, confronted this extremist assault by attacking the source. As we went after Al-Qaeda and eventually, under President Obama, cut off its head by slaying Osama bin Laden, so Israel is going after Hamas and its leaders. Tragically, but perhaps not surprisingly, for a group that cares so little for human life, Hamas has chosen to hide behind civilians in Gaza. It is understood they've even used hospitals and other places of refuge as hideouts for planning or launching their terrorist activities. As civilian casualties in Gaza mount, it is important to remember this fact. For not only was the cowardly attack of October 7th launched against Israeli civilians, but Hamas then retreated to hide behind its own civilians, thereby maximizing innocent casualties. Recent interviews of Hamas leaders living safely in other Arab nations like Qatar have admitted as much. They've brazenly asserted that their concern the Palestinian cause was fading from public attention prompted the vicious attack on October 7th to gain attention and to maximize casualties, including those in Gaza. They did this perversely to gain sympathy for their cause. The blame for the ensuing carnage clearly rests squarely on Hamas. Their own extremism, like that of Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups, brought righteous wrath to their doorstep. Yet it cannot be overlooked that Israel is not without blame regarding the woeful condition of Palestinians. In the past, Israel has shown considerable forbearance in dealing with hostile Arab nations. For example, they allowed continued Arab control of the Temple Mount, Haram al-Sharif in Jerusalem, a site sacred to both Jews and Muslims, after the 1967 war, when Israel gained control over all of Jerusalem, and they restored Gaza to Palestinian control back in 2005. Yet this forbearance has not been evident in more recent years. Benjamin Netanyahu's aggressive promotion of Israeli settlements throughout the West Bank in what is supposed to be Palestinian territory has provoked extraordinary hardship for the Palestinians living there. The repeated undermining of the Palestinian Authority, which could provide a less militant alternative to that of Hamas, has also hurt prospects for peace. It now appears Hamas's attack on October 7th from Gaza may have been aided in part by Netanyahu's own preoccupation with West Bank settlements, causing Israeli security to overlook threats from Gaza. The problem, both ways, for Israelis and Palestinians comes from religious extremists undercutting prospects for peaceful coexistence in this troubled part of the world. If religious zealots could be contained and controlled on both sides, a two-state solution such as that historically favored by the United States might yet work. Sadly, that is a very big if, which, given current conditions, seems increasingly unlikely. Some hope lies in the fact that extremists rarely prevail. Their very radicalism isolates and ultimately destroys them. For the sake of both Israelis and Palestinians, we can only hope this day comes soon. Again, that opinion piece by Mark Schweibert, a lawyer and former mayor of Rock Island.
Now I guess we'll turn over to the sports page and we'll give you a rundown of what's all on sports television today. College men's basketball, 5:30 p.m., Minnesota at Indiana on FS1. 6 p.m., Buffalo at Akron on CBS Sports Network. Also 6 p.m., Dayton at Duquesne, ESPN2. 6 p.m., Rice at South Florida on ESPNU. At 7:30 p.m., it's DePaul at Villanova on FS1. 8 p.m., Wright State at Youngstown State on ESPN2. 8:30 p.m., Nebraska at Iowa on the Big Ten Network. And at 9:30 p.m. on FS1, it's Boise State at Nevada. College women's basketball, 7 p.m. on the Pac-12 Network. It's Stanford at Utah. And at 9 p.m. on the Pac-12 Network, it's Arizona at Oregon State. And in the NBA, on ESPN at 6:40 p.m., it's Sacramento at Philadelphia. At 7 p.m. on the NBC Sports Network out of Chicago, it's Golden State at Chicago. And at 9:05 p.m. on ESPN, it's New Orleans at Denver. And on the NHL Network at 7 p.m., you can see Nashville take on Dallas. And in high school basketball, Lancers pass test. North Scott pulls away in second half. During finals week, the North Scott High School boys basketball team got a serious test from visiting Davenport North Wildcats on Thursday evening for a half. In the second half, the state's Class 4A fifth-ranked Lancers put their collective noses to the grindstone, went back to basics, and ran away with a 60-41 Mississippi Athletic Conference decision over the Wildcats at the Pit. They just wanted it more than we did, I felt like, North Scott senior Josiah Harrington said of the first half. We weren't moving the ball and taking bad shots. That resulted in a competitive, if not aesthetic, first half as the Lancers settled for a 28-25 lead at the break in the physical contest. North Scott trailed 22-17 when North's Darian Manning hit a three-pointer with 6 minutes 42 seconds left in the second quarter. From there, the Lancers answered with triples from Kyler Garrity, Brendan Reed, and Kayvon Phillips to help close the half on an 11-3 run. Thought we were doing everything we needed to do to stay in the game, knowing they are a ranked team and a high-powered scoring offense, said North coach Marquez Davis after his club fell to a record of 7-5, 4 wins, 5 losses in MAC play. They've got 6 or 7 guys that can be the best player on the floor. Our goal was to come in and be as solid as we can, and I thought we did that in the first half. In the second half, they came out and made shots, and we didn't. Then we couldn't get, flipping the page here, back over the hump. In the second half, the Lancers came out more focused and determined to work the ball into the paint as 9 of their first 10 buckets of the second half were either at the rim or on drives or short jump shots in the lane. We challenged them at halftime. We've always had the motto that we is greater than me. And I thought in the first half we were more of a me team, said North Scott coach Dave McLaughlin. Sharing the ball led to a much more fluid second half for the hosts, who shot 14 of 22 from the field in the final 16 minutes, even with reserves closing out the final 3 minutes. For the game, the Lancers were 23 of 45 from the field. After sitting out a considerable chunk of time in the first half with 2 fouls, Harrington made his presence felt in the second half. He scored 11 of his game-high 16 points in the final quarter and a half before benches were emptied. He did that without missing a shot. On Wednesday, North watched the Bettendorf Bulldogs knock down 13 three-pointers in a 75-35 setback before having the Lancers work them over inside on Thursday.
And to girls basketball, Panthers' Stymie Alleman. This by Samir Mala of the Times. Live by the three, die by the three. That basketball mantra was on full display Thursday night at the Panther Den. The visiting Alleman Pioneers fell to the United Township Panthers 44-31 on an evening where the Pioneers went 1-for-22 from beyond the arc. I think the game went really well, United Township head coach Chase Pavlonis said. Hats off to Alleman. They are an outstanding team. We knew it was going to be a dogfight for all four quarters and that we had to be relentless, but that's what it took to win. United Township switched from the traditional man-to-man defense to a 2-3 zone throughout the game, flummoxing the Alleman offense. The Pioneers were stagnant, as the typical ball movement to find open shooters just was not there on Thursday. Long possessions resulted in forced, missed, contested Pioneer shots. You just try to put the team in the best position possible, Pavlonis said of his team switching to zone defense on Thursday night. I think we did that today. We have been working on our defense a lot recently, so I think we did pretty good, United Township senior center Lorena Awau said. I think the 2-3 zone helped us when we were tired, but also when we needed to get out of a jam as well. Awau finished with a game-high 20 points on her 18th birthday in front of her home crowd. She only had 2 first-quarter points but did the bulk of her scoring in the fourth quarter. Awau's teammates found her on transition layups often, as Awau scored 9 of her 20 in the final frame. It's really exciting to get a win on my birthday, Awau said. The Panthers, in their alternate white jerseys with pink seams to promote breast cancer awareness, started the first quarter strong. United Township opened to a blistering 12-2 lead, going 3-for-6 from the field and forcing the Pioneers into a 0-for-4 start and 4 turnovers within the first 5 minutes and 30 seconds. Alleman head coach Steve Ford had to call consecutive timeouts and told his players to calm down. Alleman found its composure. The Pioneers went on a 6-1 run to close the opening period, then took their first lead, which was 16-15, with 4:43 left in the second quarter, following a 3-point play by senior forward Ava Brinkman. However, despite 4 lead changes within the next 2-plus minutes and the game tied at 22-all heading into the second half, the Panthers opened the scoring in the third quarter and did not look back. The Pioneers' first and only made 3-pointer came with under 30 seconds left in the final frame, with the game already out of reach. Alleman's leading scorer was senior guard Claire Hulke, who had 10 points in the loss. The Pioneers, who are 19-3 and 5-3, traveled to Riverdale to face the Rams, who are 14-4 in a non-conference affair on Monday night. As for United Township, which is 17-4 and 7-1, they too will also be playing a non-conference game, but against the Maine South Hawks, who are 20-0 on Saturday afternoon at home.
Here's a couple of local sports briefs. St. Ambrose moves Saturday's games to Sunday. St. Ambrose CCAC basketball doubleheader scheduled for Saturday against Indiana South Bend at Lee Loman Arena has been moved to Sunday because of weather. The women's game starts at 1 p.m. with the men to follow. And Iowa's Welker earns award. Iowa's Kylie Welker has been named USA Wrestling's Athlete of the Week. Welker went 3-0 at 170 pounds to help the Hawkeyes win the team title last weekend at the NWCA National Duels in Cedar Falls. Welker from Franksville, Wisconsin, is ranked number one in the country at 170 pounds. The Hawkeyes are back in action January 21st, hosting Life University and Missouri Valley College beginning at 2 p.m. And a couple quick headlines on the front page of the sports section before we close out for the day. End of a successful era. Patriots and Bill Belichick part company after 4-13 season. I was going to see here if I can remember. 24 years Bill Belichick has been the coach of the Patriots. It's long time, especially in the NFL. And in college men's basketball, teams in top 25 show vulnerability. Four of the top five fall to unranked foes on Tuesday and Wednesday. So it was a topsy-turvy week in men's college basketball. Let's see, one quick thing here. Preview for the Iowa versus Nebraska game tonight. The bottom line, Iowa plays the Cornhuskers after Peyton Sanford scored 24 points in Iowa's 86-77 victory over Rutgers' Scarlet Knights. The Cornhuskers, meanwhile, are coming off an upset Tuesday against top-ranked Purdue. The Hawkeyes have gone 7-1 in home games. Iowa is fourth in the Big Ten with a 25.7 defensive rebounds per game lead, led by Sanford, averaging 5.3. The Huskers are 3-2 against Big Ten opponents. Nebraska ranks third in the Big Ten with 26.3 defensive rebounds per game, led by Rank Mast, averaging 6.2. Iowa makes 47.5% of its shots from the field this season, which is 8.3 percentage points higher than Nebraska has allowed to its opponents. Nebraska averages 78.4 points per game, 0.8 more than the 77.6 Iowa allows.
That brings us to the end of the Quad City Times for this snowy Friday, January 12th. My name is Rachel Mithelman, and my partner at the microphone has been Scott Splavik. You can listen to IRA's programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. We thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.